The year this week's album came out, the 44-year-long Cold War came to an abrupt end when the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics fell unexpectedly. The United States invaded Iraq, because apparently that's something we have to do every so often. And the South African government status of apartheid ended. Capcom released Street Fighter II, the arcade game, that was in every pizza parlor in America. This really turned me on to fighting games, and I still own an arcade cabinet with it on it. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Then there was this week's band. They released their fifth studio album, their first mega hit. They made a stupid amount of sales on this one. They toured it extensively, including 20 years after they released it, they decided to tour it again. If the Beatles had the White Album, this band has the Black Album. Have you guessed it yet? The year was 1991, the artist is Metallica, and the album is Metallica. Today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Welcome to the greatest show in podcasting, where the hosts will literally talk about anything. But you're not here to learn about traditional methods of agriculture and literal grass growing. You're here to listen to Two Dudes and Tunes with Wood and Chris. I'm Wood, and I'm joined as always by my good friend Chris. Chris, this week's episode is about Metallica. What do you think about that?
Man, I was super excited because I feel like, and this is mainly my fault, we've had a long string of very sad albums from me. And when Metallica popped up, I was like, oh good, we're gonna have some fun. Maybe we can keep Wood smiling this episode instead of giving you an existential crisis.
Oh man, so, the last couple of weeks have made me question my existence, let alone.
It's like, oh, should I even be doing this with this mopey bastard?
Nah. Well, what's new with you in the tippy top of Texas, man?
You know what? The thing that's been kind of new with me, I've been trying to engage the writing part of my brain. As listeners probably know, because I say it probably too often, I went to school for music. I didn't go for creative writing, but it's something I kind of enjoy. And a good friend of mine from college kind of encouraged me to start writing. So I am once again leveling my lance at that particular windmill. And it basically amounts to me just sitting and thinking about things while I drive a forklift. That's the unvarnished version of pre-writing. If somebody tells you they're doing a bunch of pre-writing, it means they're just like staring at their keyboard or looking off into the distance. So that's kind of the stage I'm at right now. But man, other than that, it's just work. What about you? How have things been going for you?
Well, on the writing perspective, you and I have kind of taken up writing challenges over the years. And for a while back there, we were sending each other stuff back and forth and kind of critiquing each other. And that's something I kind of miss doing. I am a constant idea journaler. I have whole notebooks on this bookshelf next to me that are just my bad ideas penned down into like paragraph form. Like maybe one day I'll open it up and start following the prompts, sticking some dots together.
Hey, do it. I'm kind of sort of doing that. I have a Word document or a Google Doc rather on my phone that occasionally when I should be working, I open. And it, usually what happens is I'll type something out and then a day will pass and I'll open it up again and look at it and go, oh, that's dumb. And then I'll like highlight it and do the strike through thing. So I have these like documents just riddled with like, should I do this? Nah, I probably shouldn't do this. But this would be kind of cool, but I don't like that. Just back and forth.
I try not to self-censor myself. I just keep going. And if something really sticks, it'll keep coming to the surface.
So, yeah. Yeah. But that's the way to do it. I mean, I'm sure you know how it is when you're searching for that thing that like clicks. It's hard not to be like, oh, well, that's stupid. Maybe I should go this direction. And that's why I strike through. I try not to just straight up erase because the songwriting part of my brain is like, what if that was the greatest thing that you just like deleted forever and you'll forget it? So that's been my creative writing struggle as well.
Awesome. Well, what else is new?
Like I said, not much. I did watch one of my very favorite Star Trek films, Star Trek First Contact.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
And I hadn't seen it since, I don't think I'd seen it since 1996 when it came out. Mm-hmm. And I'm also another thing to know about me, listeners. I'm a huge Trekkie. Like big time nerd over here. And something about the motion pictures, the like Star Trek TNG films always rubs me the wrong way. Cause some of them aren't very good. And it feels like when you dream about a family member, but they're not them. If that makes sense, I'm watching these people whose faces are familiar to me, but the script is bad. And the characters have been like, drained of all the things that make them the characters.
Yeah.
But First Contact is a good one. It's a lot of fun. And it has James Cromwell. Is that name?
Yep. Yep.
As Zefram Cochrane. And that's fantastic. So I watched that one.
So let's play keep, trade, cut, or whatever you want to call it for what's your favorite, least favorite. You can only keep one of these, Deep Space Nine or Next Generation.
Oh man, that hurts my soul just even thinking about it. I recently watched all of Deep Space Nine because I listen along with a podcast I really like called The Greatest Generation, and they covered that one, and it was way better than I expected it to be, that show. Mm-hmm. Man, I gotta stick with JL Pipes, as they call him in The Greatest Generation. I gotta nix Ben Sisko, even though that whole show is fantastic. I got to say goodbye to Deep Space Nine. Chuck him through the wormhole. let the Cardassians have him. Yeah, man, that's a good one. That's tough. Yeah, man, I've just been nerding out, basically. What about you? How's your week been?
I started 2 weeks of paternity leave on Monday, which was really nice, especially after the day I had on Friday. I was up in Dallas. We recorded last Thursday night from my hotel room. And then while I was at the shop, I had to have the touchy HR conversation of, hey, you can't sleep with your coworkers at work. So I was ready for 2 weeks of vacation after that conversation.
Oh, I believe it.
But so I've just kind of been hanging out with Maverick. Tiffany's getting ready to transition to kind of a part-time work schedule so she can be home with him a little bit more often now that he's bit older and getting a little bit more mobile and needing more attention. So kind of with that, it's me helping out around here trying to get things squared away for that transition. But it's been nice. I have not gotten as much done as I was hoping to. I still need to mow the yard. I have a bunch of cleaning to do. Like, you can't see the video, folks, but my office looks like a literal bomb went off in it right now. And that's life.
I do have to say, you said in your intro that we wouldn't be talking about traditional methods of agriculture and literal grass growing, but you did just mention mowing your lawn. So there's something here for everyone.
And I'm wearing my A&M hat. So, you know,
hey, let's talk about
traditional agriculture.
Yeah, you have gone full Aggie. I love it.
In defense, my family's a whole bunch of farmers. So,
hey, that is a job that has always impressed me. I think my granddad, my mother's father, he was a farmer for a time. Mm-hmm. That is a hard life. I have nothing but respect for people who farm because I would get frustrated and torch the field and be unemployed. That is what would happen.
So my family has been farmers up in West Texas, close to where Chris lives, for 4 generations now. And now my dad is taking over the farming, which is kind of funny to me. He's doing more of an administration kind of thing, but he swore he would never be a farmer. And he's subletting out our property and handling all of that. So my dad is now a farmer, which means
he's like Michael Corleone. They keep dragging him back in.
At some point, that means I'm going to be a farmer. Which, okay.
Ooh. But,
there's a joke about
do what farming. Your dad does. And
oh yeah.
Oh totally. Yeah. Go ahead.
So there's a joke about farming. They talk about daylight savings time, you know, being for the farmers. And it doesn't matter. We can collect an insurance check in the dark just as well as we can during the daylight. So
I like it. I like it a lot. That's so funny. Yeah, definitely try and get in on the administration side.
Oh, yeah, totes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some farmers that go to the church that Megan and I used to attend. And man, like,
it's a hard it's life, tough. Man. Yeah.
Every little thing, and especially on the plains where the weather is so erratic, and especially like for cotton farmers up here, that can be so tough because, you know, you get one hail storm during the wrong part of the season, or
just rain, you know, at the wrong part
rain.
Of the season.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of rain to ruin a cotton crop after the cotton has sprouted. So being really, really careful doesn't. With that. So, but anyhow, enough about agriculture. Let's talk about Metallica, man.
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right, Chris, we're talking about Metallica's Metallica album. Apparently on my list, I am in love with albums that are named after the band. I noticed that's a common theme on my list. So here we go.
You know what? I spent all week in text to you, I think, referring to this as Fade to Black.
Which it is not.
Which it is not. Fade to Black is on a completely different album entirely. And also, it's funny that you mentioned the Black album, because I always, that was the other misconception I had, is that this one was just kind of colloquially known as the Black album. I didn't know it was their self-titled.
So that's the thing. Yeah, it's self-titled. But on the album art, it's literally just the black, whatever. It's a two-tone black background with the Gadsden Snake, or part of the Gadsden Snake, on it.
Which, yeah.
If you're not looking at it in the right light, it just looks like the White Album, except it's black. So everybody calls it the Black Album, even though it's Metallica.
I can't decide. Like, I think I really like the album art. But also their name is kind of, it looks like a mistake.
It's like they misprinted a whole bunch of them. Like
the name isn't. Yeah. Yeah. Because the snake shows up and it looks cool. But the I don't know. I think for me, I actually do really like the album art. We don't really talk about album art that much. But I think, like, especially for a metal band, it's pretty slick.
Well, and I really like the album art overall, just because it is so clean, and it is so, one of the reasons it's so good is because the album, the music that is on it, is so iconic. Metallica was a well-known metal band before this album came out. You know, their first four albums did really well, especially in the metal genre, but this album put them on the map with everybody. This album made them a household name, and it's a very popular album even to this day. We'll get into that here in a little bit about how popular this album has been over the years. But needless to say, 25 years after they released this album, they toured it again. They still play these songs at their concerts. They still, you know, most of their huge hits are right here on this album. So with that kind of said, the album artwork takes a whole nother swing for the fences now that the album has solidified itself as probably one of the greatest metal albums ever produced, period.
Mm-hmm. What something that's kind of funny to me, you were saying they were popular before this album came out. I forget what documentary it was I was watching or where I picked up this information, but it's interesting because this album has a lot of real heavy moments. But some of the stuff like Nothing Else Matters, I'm trying to remember, maybe The Unforgiven as well. Mm-hmm. Like, hardcore metal fans really kind of took Metallica to task for, like, kind of quote unquote going soft. Yeah. Like, oh, you guys have acoustic stuff now. Like, y'all are a bunch of pansies, which is funny because those are two of the strongest tracks on the album.
Hands down.
Like, I'm not necessarily a fan. We don't have to like spend a lot of time on this. I'm not necessarily a fan of the way the acoustic guitars are produced mm-hmm. with the like chorus and like they sound really heavily affected, but man, the parts are just so good. It's funny to me how this album I think had a little bit to overcome from diehard metal fans, whereas probably people who were just hearing it for the first time, I imagine it attracted a lot of outside fans, mm-hmm. you know, because Metallica is one of those bands that people who don't even really listen to metal that much really get into their music.
Oh yeah. You know? Well, in this album specifically, and Metallica as a whole, I guess, really is a gateway band into the metal genre of music. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, going back to the Jack Johnson phrase, accessibility, mm-hmm. it really does kind of just hit itself in a pretty much non-offensive way for everybody. You know, metal comes on and you don't just immediately turn it off. And it's funny. We've had this album for a little over a week now on our playlist as we've been preparing for this episode. And it seems like every time I turn on my truck, there is a Metallica song from this album on the radio, on the local rock station. Like every time nice. I get in the truck, it's like, it's another Metallica song. Here we go.
Hey, that's not so bad given what is on hard rock radio right now. Exactly. It could be a lot worse.
Exactly. But so before we get any further into this album, I'm curious to hear what was your first experience with this album?
So my first experience, one of the things I enjoyed about having this album this week is it brought me back to the time that I spent in Ohio. So my freshman year of high school, my dad was deployed to Iraq for like 7-ish months. And so dad was stationed in Germany at that time, and we moved back to Ohio where we had lived for a time before 9/11. We moved back there so that my mom would have like kind of a security network for raising me and my brother and sister, mm-hmm. Because she had a lot of friends there. And so I spent the first semester of my freshman year of high school in Ohio, spending time with friends I had made from grade school years earlier. And one of my closest friends, her dad really liked Metallica. And I feel like either he gave me like a mix CD with a bunch of stuff on it and some tracks from their self-titled was on it or something like that. But I'm pretty sure it was all songs from this album. Because these are the songs from their music that I'm most familiar with. And I don't know. It was a really pleasant time in my life, despite dad being deployed. I had a lot of good friends and I listened to Metallica and I was, you know, this little angsty freshman in high school. And it was fun. You know, I'm always a little reluctant to admit that I like Metallica because, like, at this point, they're kind of the pumpkin spice latte of metal. They're a little basic. They were like groundbreaking. And so, like, I don't know. It's kind of got a few of the elements of like a guilty pleasure where I'm like, oh, I'm a dirty boy listening to Metallica, slumming it.
Hearing you use the pumpkin spice latte reference, when I read that in the notes, I was like, well, that makes the Foo Fighters the vanilla frappuccino.
Yeah, and yeah.
That's really scary. Really does.
Hey, look, we don't need to be ashamed There's of being a couple place. Of like, yeah, exactly. Couple of white dudes. We can listen to our like radio friendly hard rock. But yeah, that was really my introduction to Metallica. And I've just kind of picked up on more and more of their discography here and there. This morning I was listening to Kill 'Em All, which is fantastic because it's way more like grungy thrash. You know, Lars Ulrich hasn't retreated into his like super simple caveman beats yet. He's still doing like really fast paced drumming that's like more fun. So
yeah, definitely.
What is your entry point from Metallica?
So I remember getting this album either in 1999 or the year 2000, which would have put me at 11 or 12 years old. And I picked up a cassette tape of it somewhere. I can't remember where exactly, but I remember distinctly playing the cassette tape and flipping it over from side A to side B on this old Sanyo boombox that I had in my bedroom. Mm-hmm. And really, this was groundbreaking to me. It was, I had never heard anything like it before in my life. I mean, 11 or 12 years old is probably too early to be listening to Metallica, but it was just amazing. And I remember just immediately falling in love with this album because of that. And as I got into high school, as I got older, this became one of those, you know, or a lot of the tracks on this became just common parts of my amp up playlist, my mixed tracks for getting ready to be competitive at sports or getting ready for whatever, getting my mindset into that just, yeah, we're going to go win. So this music really was kind of that gateway for me into the metal genre of music. And I've always kind of liked it. I think it's a fun album as a whole. So with that kind of said, I want to talk a little bit about the album itself, if you're ready.
Absolutely. Let's dive in.
So earlier we said that this was the first album to open at number one for Metallica, and it was just incredibly popular just from day one, and it was unexpected for Metallica. There's a pretty famous quote by Lars Ulrich that they were hanging out in a hotel room getting ready to do something, and he was asked, you know, how did you find out about your album being opening at number one? And he says, you think one day some fornicator is going to tell you you have a number one record in America and the whole world will expletive. I stood there in my hotel room and there was this fax that said you're number one. And I was like, well, okay. It was just another friggin' fax from the office.
Imagine being able to be that nonchalant about number one. Lars Ulrich, whatever else you might say about him, and I will complain about him later on today. Dude has personality for days. Yeah. Yeah. That is so funny.
He has the ultimate rock and roll attitude as far as just the way he approaches life in general, and sometimes not for the good. Like, he's not just a good person. For sure.
We've all seen some kind of monster. Like, we know what kind of a dude he is.
But this album did sell almost 600,000 copies in the USA in its first week. Moved in 1991. I mean, the internet wasn't even a thing. Like, just people were at record stores buying this thing. It has gone 16 times platinum in the United States. It has sold 25.2 million copies worldwide total, which places it at like number 13 all time in number of albums sold. So this is a big album.
Yeah, no joke. I had no idea it was that big.
It has been on the Billboard Top 200 charts in the United States for a total of 488 weeks. And it was on the boards, then it falls off, and then it comes back because it's featured in some sort of documentary, or it's the soundtrack or partial soundtrack to a movie or whatever. But 488 weeks, that's almost 10 years since 1991 that this thing has been on the Billboard 200. And as of this recording, it's 128 on the Billboard 200. It's also the oldest album on the Billboard 200.
Is it really? Yeah.
That's this album's interesting. 30 years old, Chris.
Oh, no. Well, I'm 32, which makes sense. Actually, you know what? This album and my wife are the same age. Megan turns 30 in August. That is awesome. The day before I do. So,
well, this album came out on August 12th, 1991. Oh, man.
That's so funny. Just a few short days after my wife was born, boom.
She Metallica brought great things with her, apparently.
She did. She definitely did. Dude, it's funny to me how universal an appeal Metallica has. You know, I like the guys that I work with, like my coworkers, I don't have that much in common with them, just by happenstance, not for any significant reason. But music is something I can always kind of bond with them over. And Metallica is one of those bands that it doesn't seem to matter who I come in contact with, I can usually find at least one or two people who really like Metallica. Mm-hmm. Like, their fans are everywhere. And it's always interesting to me when a heavy metal band has kind of universal appeal. Mm-hmm. Because I always think of it as this kind of outsider music. And I don't know whether that's just the, you know, decade that I grew up in, where it was for all the like super sad or super angry kids who wore all black and Jinko jeans and wallet chains. But like, they really do have a universal appeal. It's interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think some of that has to do with just where the band falls in the timeline of metal music and the timeline of music accessibility. So Metallica formed in 1981 in Los Angeles, I believe. And mm-hmm. so you've got those people who were boomers, you know, baby boomers, who were in their early 20s at the time, or, you know, mid 20s at the time this band got together. And by 1990, they're in their, you know, the tail end of the boomers are in their early 30s. So they're your and my age. And now they're, you know, approaching 65 years old, 70 years old. But this is the music that was popular when they were our age. So I think a lot of just the way they have spanned generations and the way that we consume media has changed has made them kind of a gateway to all things metal. And so many, you know, they kind of split generations because of when they were formed. And just because it was metal, it's not classic rock. It doesn't fall in that 70s and 80s classic rock genre at all. But it was kind of bridging the gap for, you know, our parents and in a few cases, our grandparents. And here we are today still talking about them. They're still together.
Yeah, they come at an interesting time for sure. You know, you look at the history of like rock music, and you've got like pioneers in the 50s, and then people taking those ideas in the 60s and expanding on them, and then people continuing to expand on those ideas in the 70s. And so like, by the time you hit the 80s when they formed, you've got three decades of rock mm-hmm. evolution. And so in that time, you've got like punk is starting to like become more mainstream, but you've also got hard rock bands like Thin Lizzy mm-hmm. and like Iron Maiden is kind yeah. of cranking up at that time. So I think it's, I don't know, it's such a fruitful time for metal, because I think people have already started to get heavy mm-hmm. with their music, right? Bands like Black Sabbath.
They're looking for the next Judas Priest big thing.
Yeah. And so they're just pushing it to extremes and extremes and extremes. And it's kind of why I brought up the pumpkin spice latte thing, because I think it's hilarious, because Metallica used to be the bleeding edge
yeah.
of heavy music. And now, like, one of the guys I work with is a big metal head. And, like, he was talking to another coworker of mine who was talking about System of a Down. And this guy just innocently brought up one of the really big tunes from Toxicity. Mm-hmm. And was like, oh, yeah, Toxicity is my favorite song or whatever. And my other coworker was like, oh, that's like the basic yeah. option. Everybody loves, you know, there's such a, unfortunately,
20 years amongst ago, that some was metal mainlining fans. Heroin.
Yeah, now, exactly.
Now it's like just Tylenol.
Exactly. There's this like one upsmanship that metalheads really engage in that is super unfortunate. You know, that kind of gatekeeping. But I don't know, man. It's good. It's classic for a reason.
I'm going to self-edit myself here. A couple of minutes ago, I said it had spent 488 weeks on the Billboard Top 200. That was data from 2014. As of 2020, it's spent 557 weeks on the Billboard 200, and it's the oldest album and longest on the charts ever.
So, oh, man.
There you go.
I had no idea.
Neither did I. Funny. I just figured it out.
Yeah, this, like, for me, from a guitar point of view, especially, this album was really a joy to put on. You know, a lot is made of lead guitarists just in popular culture. Maybe not so much now, but, you know, for decades and decades, it's always been about whoever is up there shredding way up high on the tiny strings. And this is one band that really flips that on its head. Like, not to throw any shade on Kirk Hammett, but James Hetfield's riff writing is some of my absolute favorite stuff. Well, like,
look at how that changes metal music in general, though, because metal isn't so popular for its solos and its, you know, being crazy. It's driven by the rhythm. It's driven by how you couple bass and drums with that guitar and really drive something forward. And I think that all starts here. I mean, Iron Maiden is still very solo heavy. Thin Lizzy is as well. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it kind of cuts both ways, because the bands you mentioned, like, especially a band like Iron Maiden, that's a lot of, like, both those guitarists are fantastic. Oh, yeah. And so they're not harmonized lines. No, I didn't take it as knocking it, but I think it's an aspect of music that can be underrated by metal bands, because some of those guitarists are so focused on, I'm going to play as fast and loud and crazy as possible. But with this band specifically, they kind of get into territory where even people who aren't really into metal but are just learning to play guitar are going to sit down and try and plunk out Enter Sandman. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the opening strains of Nothing Else Matters. Like, they've really ascended to a level that previously, like, AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath had, where, like, that was the stuff you were hearing at guitar stores, which I know I talk about that probably a lot, but that's just kind of an easy gauge. What are people looking to learn to play their instrument?
Yep.
And Metallica is definitely one of those bands. And it, like, no, I don't want necessarily, if you're playing Two Dudes in Tunes Bingo, you can put a chip on the, I don't want to bore people with guitar technique, but square, because I don't want to bore people with guitar technique. But one of the things that can be really challenging when you're playing guitar is really getting good coordination in your pick hand, in your right hand, usually if you're right-handed, left-handed, if you're left-handed, obviously. But that's something that James Hetfield just has in spades. Like, the guy has such hand-eye coordination and such fine muscle memory that the music seems really tight. He's always really locked in with Lars, especially on this album. Him and Cliff Burton, the bassist, and Lars are just this unbeatable, like, steam locomotive that just chugs along. And it's just so good. Like, Sad But True, Wherever I May Roam. Through the Never is one that I don't think I'd ever actually heard before, but is really excellent. So that was one of the things that I, of course, like, knew about Metallica going into this. But it was nice to, like, sit in that, because they're not a band that I listen to a lot. Like, I love them when I get in the mood, but I was like, man, like, I'm kind of okay with listening to this all week long, because it was just so good.
It's funny that you mention in the mood. When the Oracle picked this one for us, we were off air. We weren't recording, but we were talking together live from another recording. And this one came up and I was like, oh, shoot. Like, this is on my list and I just don't think I can do this album. And you're like, what album? Like, what is it? I'm like, it's Metallica, man. Like, I'm not in the mood.
And you had to kind of come back up from your, like, downer.
Oh, no. So it wasn't even a downer, because the second we logged off, I started playing it. Generally, when I'm packing up my stuff, I start listening to next week's album and getting kind of cleansed of whatever we just did and getting my mind around that. And it had easily been 10 years since I'd listened to this album. And it had probably been about 10 years since I had seriously listened to any metal music. About the time that I graduated with my bachelor's degree was about the time I stopped psyching myself up for very much stuff. So it was funny going off. Oh yeah, exactly. Even with my master's degree, it wasn't really something I thought about having to do, but I went back to my old Spotify playlist. Thanks for being a subscriber since day one. And all those metal playlists were in there, and I really got into metal music this week, thanks again to this album. So it's like the second coming of the Gateway.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny how that works, because I find that I don't listen, and I think this is probably something that divides both of us from like your average metalhead, is like, I am not always in the mood for the like brutally heavy drums and guitar of a band like Metallica, but man, when I'm in the mood for it, that's almost all I want to listen to. If I'm going to listen to music, like System of a Down kind of takes me over in the same way.
Yeah,
where I just put their whole discography on my phone and shuffle it, usually in the morning, because I need something to amp me up at work. But this album definitely got a lot of playtime in the mornings to like get me going and get me like through the work day.
At my job, I'm expected to be the calm-headed, level-headed voice of reason. So amping myself up is not what they want me to do in the morning. They're like, just wake up and be ready to solve conflict, not conquer the world.
Oh, man. Ready to, like, put some chairs through windows. And that's so funny. It's like,
who are we going to fire today? But
oh, no.
But, oh, no, man. So one of the things I thought was interesting in doing some research for this album, not to change the topic on you, is just much of this album is solely written by James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich, who they're both named on every song in that order. It's James Hetfield, then Lars Ulrich. And the lyrics were all written by James Hetfield. I know your feelings about Lars as a drummer. What are your feelings about Lars as a co-writer?
So I wonder what his role is. And it's one of those things that I kind of tend to forget because I haven't been in a full band for a while. But if you've played music, you kind of, in a full band, you kind of realize how much of the structure of a song is in the drummer's purview.
Mm-hmm.
Because even, I'm gonna sound like so snooty, even a drummer like Lars Ulrich is going to have some idea of moving from section to section of a song. How should I build this up? How should I interact with it? How should I create tension and release? Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how much of Metallica, how much of what I like about Metallica is because of Lars Ulrich, if maybe he has a good head for structure and stuff, and his playing is just not up to scratch. Because if I had one sticking point about Metallica, is it's one of the best rhythm guitarists and one of the best bassists in the world, coupled with one of the less good lead guitarists and a drummer whose work I am usually just not a fan of at all. His sounds can like the influence he has over their production can be kind of goofy. Like the album Saint Anger kind of got lampooned by a lot of people because the drums sounded like trash cans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to And Justice for All today, and that album is remarkably dry. Mm-hmm. Like there's no reverb in it at all. And the drums sound really flat and like a little lifeless to me. But on this album, I kind of like what Lars is doing, which I don't usually. I'm usually kind of like, man, you're going for the simplest option. And I also think the production of the band in general, and particularly the drums, is stronger than it usually is. And so I kind of liked him in this album. That's one of the things that commended this album to me in the first place, is that listening to it you know, whenever I listen to Metallica, I'm kind of primed to go like, okay, well, the drumming's not going to be great. But this album, I kind of liked it. I was really kind of surprised, pleasantly so, of course.
Yeah, and so you and I have talked on this show in the past, and I think when we picked this album, we even kind of touched on it, about this album and Metallica as a whole as a band seems to be a very collaborative band. It's not like Pink Floyd, where you got, you know, one guy hold up writing an entire album, and then the next album is another guy hold up writing the whole album. Metallica, from all the documentaries I've seen, of all the, as Alex Jones would say, of all the footage I've seen, it just seems like they are so wrapped around what is right for the band, and that means writing stuff is a band decision. And so I tend to lean on, I think Lars is probably a phenomenal writer and a phenomenal collaborator. Like, he's a good team member. But I agree. There are a couple tracks even on this album that I do not like the drumming on. In fact, one of the songs on this album is my least favorite because of the drums, not for any other reason, just the drums are terrible. And it's going to be my least favorite here in a little bit.
It's one of those things. And I think probably one of the factors that makes it probably a little bit hard for people to get into Metallica if they're our age or younger is that there's some metal music has become so much more extreme. The technical ability that a lot of metal bands have now kind of blows, well, definitely blows Lars Ulrich out of the water. And so if you're looking for something that kind of pushes music to those extremes, Metallica doesn't necessarily have that. And even somebody like System of a Down, I have one of their albums on our list. Their drummer is amazing. He's got a grasp of a lot of different styles. He incorporates a lot of them into System of a Down's music. He's also got chops for days. And so I think that they might be at a disadvantage in the same way like a Godzilla movie would be at a disadvantage to a modern moviegoer who goes like, well, it's clearly a dude in a suit and these little planes are on wires. Like, why should I care about this? But I want to pivot a little bit because I was looking here. So the guy who recorded or who produced rather this album.
I am so glad you brought that up because I want to talk about Bob Rock too.
Transition. worked with Motley Crue on Dr. Feelgood. So you already know he's going to have like a slick kind of approach to things. But I'm reading here in the Wikipedia album, he had the band make the album in different ways. He asked them to record songs collaboratively, rather than individually in separate locations. He also suggested recording tracks live and using harmonic vocals for Hetfield. So I think that you've definitely hit the nail on the head when you're talking about it sounds like they're all making decisions as a band. It seems like they're all very much in tune together instead of each of them kind of vying for their little corner of the album. And then you have these songs that like are less than the sum of their parts. But what did you want to say about Bob Rock?
He is the unsung hero of rock and roll, period. First of all, the guy has produced for literally everybody. In 1991 alone, the year this album came out, he also produced David Lee Roth's A Little Ain't Enough and Motley Crue's Decade of Decadence album. Like, 91 was a busy year for him. When you look at the people he's worked with, he's worked with everybody from Cher to Bon Jovi to Bryan Adams. So, like, he's playing the whole spectrum, don't get me wrong. But what's really cool when you look at his kind of his discography, it's a lot of repeats. He's done a lot of Metallica albums. He's done a lot of Michael Bublé albums. He plays That's the so field funny. And he transitioned with Metallica. And in 2003 on Saint Anger, he recorded all the bass parts. So he's credited as the bassist on Saint Anger. So talk about being just an uncredited, like, as far as like unrecognized, just rock superhero. The last, you know, since 1979, he's been producing music and recording on lots of stuff. He recorded a bass for Dr. Feelgood as well, for Motley Crue. I mean, he's all over the place. So he's a phenomenal musician, yes, in addition to being a phenomenal producer who can work with all sorts of different people. And they don't get, I mean, just they don't looking get the light.
At the, yeah, and just looking at his production credits, he really does span a pretty big span of time, stuff from before our time, quote unquote, and like after it. Veruca Salt, The Offspring, 311, Our Lady Peace, Simple Plan, which was like a big goofy pop punk act. Like, he's done a lot of work for different kinds of hard rock and must just have a good bead on like what makes hard rock like kind of a lasting force for people.
But nobody should forget that he also recorded Shine On for Sarah McLachlan. So the biggest hit he ever had.
Oh, really? Huh?
Not even. Don't even listen to it. It's a terrible album.
Oh, okay. I won't rush out. The only thing I ever think about Sarah McLachlan is the sad
puppy, like, adoptions.
Dog. Yeah, dog adoption. Don't put the dog commercial down. In the arms of the angels.
Oh, that's great.
One of the things I wanted to bring up is I can't decide whether I like James Hetfield's songwriting or not.
You mean his lyrics or his actual,
yeah, his lyrics, like, yeah. And I'm glad you said that, 'cause I should specify, because the songs are fantastic, like the way they're structured, the melodies are really a lot of fun, but I had to remind myself constantly that like the context for listening to Metallica is going to be different than like a lot of the singer songwriters that I've been listening to lately. You know, he had some moments I liked, like My Friend of Misery. He says, they say the empty can rattles the most. The sound of your own voice must soothe you. I thought that was like a good kind of zinger. And just in general, like the lyrics to Wherever I May Roam are kind of simplistic, but I like them. Rover, wanderer, nomad, vagabond, call me what you will. And, you know, the way he like delivers those lines in the chorus is like really driving and like heavy. And I found myself also kind of liking his songs about religion, even though they're a little simplistic. But even that was kind of a mixed bag for me, too. Like in the song Holier Than Thou, I couldn't help but chuckle. He starts the song off with "the crap rolls out your mouth again." That's a terrible choice of words. Like, I just felt like that was such a, like, unintentionally, well, maybe it was intentional, I don't know, but unintentionally gross and like a little comical.
Yeah. Well, and on the lyrics front, I feel like for the most part, Hetfield's lyrics are inoffensive, which is kind of nice. Yeah. Like, they're simplistic, yeah, but they're not aiming to get anybody up in arms about anything in general. At points they're misguided, if anything, but they aren't groundbreaking. They aren't causing you to stop and really think about anything going on. They're lyrics that are clearly written to fit the theme of the song that they wrote before they wrote the lyrics. And so because of that, I kind of give them a pass, because when I'm listening to these albums, I'm not singing along with them. Like, this is not music that I'm interested in repeating the lines to. I'm listening to it to get into a mindset, and it's not the prose that gets me into that mindset.
It's a lot more about the vibe. And that's the thing that I found myself like not really grappling with, because this isn't an album I grappled with. I didn't have any kind of deep
existential. Let's be honest. There's no existential rage here.
I listened to it, enjoyed it. But at the same time, I don't want to make the mistake of just like discounting what he writes and glossing over it. But I like kept hoping there would be more there when I was thinking about lyrics.
Let's talk about James Hetfield's voice for a moment. Everybody in the 90s tried to copy him. He is the original.
Yeah, for sure. Like pretty much the only person I think you can safely say wasn't copying him and just kind of stumbled onto the same thing is Eddie Vedder, because they were both coming up around the same time and listening to the same things. But man, like,
even today, everybody in the middle, it's like, what the heck? Get over it. Get your own shtick.
Do your own thing. If you listen to anything in hard rock radio from like the middle 90s onward, like Three Doors Down and
The Worst Offender Benjamin is Creed. Like, come on.
Oh, gross. So bad. I think there's a really funny SNL skit that is kind of more centered on grunge, but sort of talks about the same sort of things, where it's like three or four different guys doing impressions of three or four famous lead singers. I don't know if you've seen that. Maybe we can find a drop and put it in. But yeah, his voice, like, it's something that I think people make fun of but don't realize is actually really good. He writes great melodies, for one thing.
I was gonna say, his voice is another instrument in this band more than it is a messenger. So
absolutely,
he's playing his voice like another part of the melody.
And like, he has the ability to deliver lyrics that would otherwise, like, if anybody else was singing them, you would just laugh in their face. I mentioned the chorus for Wherever I May Roam. Like, those notes sung in that order and that rhythm, if anybody else did it, like, it would come off as really melodramatic and silly. You know, because it's woe is me. I have this life on the road, and it's the only place where I feel that I can be me.
Hey, have you ever seen James Hetfield? That guy is massive. If he said anything, I would take him seriously at his word.
Yeah. Oh, he absolutely. Like, I imagine that he could just, like, well, maybe not now because he's like a little older, but back in his heyday, like, I wouldn't want to get in a fight with that guy.
I'm a big hombre, and I swear he could bench press me in his sleep still. So
yeah, he's a big dude. But, you know, like, he has that kind of like gruff charisma that I think you're definitely right. A lot of people looked at that and went like, oh, I can do that.
Yeah.
And it just winds up being like real milquetoast, weak sauce. And it's been copied so much that, unfortunately, I think it kind of reflects poorly on them at this point. You know, there's that kind of phenomenon where if you originated a thing and people copy it, it just becomes like noise to people.
It's flattery until it is a stereotype. At that point, you're done.
Absolutely.
Well, before we move on to critical reception, I made a joke when we talked about having this album last week that we were going to make a ton of Spinal Tap references, which, you know, that movie is kind of just a metal homage or whatever. A movie that I had totally forgotten about that is also very Metallica adjacent, that is an unsung gem that I don't know if you've ever watched, is The Rocker. With
That's a great movie. Okay, it's been while since I've seen it, but it's so funny.
So that surrounds a band. I believe their name is Vesuvius. I did not rewatch the movie this week, but a band named Vesuvius who Dwight, why am I drawing a blank on his name at the moment?
Rain Wilson. I'm usually the one drawing blanks on names. So Rain Wilson
plays their drummer before they make it big, and they're still touring in the van, you know, or whatever. And he gets kicked out of the band or quits, you know, whatever you want to say, and ends up being a tech support person for like Best Buy on their phone lines. And Vesuvius makes it to be the biggest metal band ever. And he ends up playing with just some kids. And that movie, I found myself laughing a lot about memories of that movie while listening to this album, including the bit from that movie where they're all from Ohio or wherever. And here they are 30 years later, and they all have fake British accents.
Yeah, that's listeners, if you're into like fun screwball comedies, definitely check that movie out. I want to go back and watch it now because I had forgotten about
the music in that movie. Is really good, too. Is it? Like, the soundtrack stands up on its own. kind of like School of Rock does. So
yeah,
to drop another fun man. One. All right, Chris. Well, I think we've talked enough about Metallica. Let's hear what the critics had to say.
Yeah, so for once, there's no Metacritic score for this album. We must be running into albums that are kind of like before Metacritic's time.
Well,
which I think is so funny.
It's funny to me that Metacritic didn't have a review for this, and I actually went to like Metacritic's website and searched around for it, because they're generally pretty good about doing revisionist ratings on things based on other places doing ratings and reviews, because they just aggregate them. But there's literally nothing on this as far as Metacritic goes.
I Googled just now Metallica album Metacritic, and they have Master of Puppets on here and Justice for All. It must have just slipped through the cracks or something. That's interesting.
But that said, this album was pretty much universally loved. Like I said earlier, it's been cited as a gateway into the metal genre. David Brown, writing for Entertainment Weekly, called it rock's preeminent speed metal cyclone and said Metallica may have invented a new genre, progressive thrash, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Just to interject briefly, normally I'm kind of not a fan of inventing a ton of new genre names, but one of the things I noticed on this album that I enjoyed is it does have kind of the really fast, frenetic stuff that thrash tends to have, although it's maybe not as fast as some of their earlier stuff. But their music is progressive. They write a lot of different parts and their music goes somewhere. And so I think progressive thrash is just kind of a good, like, that's a good way to refer to this music. I don't think it's stuck. I don't think you can look up progressive thrash on like Apple Music or Spotify.
Yeah.
But that is, I think that guy's hit on something, and that's just interesting to me. I wanted to point it out.
Just looking at a couple of words here, David Cavanaugh, writing for Select, said that this album was disarmingly genuine, that it lacked artifice, but it was disarmingly genuine. And then Robert Palmer for Rolling Stones said that it was a sounds like hard rock classics, and apart from Don't Tread on Me, is an exemplary album of mature but still kick-ass rock and roll, which I feel is warranted and fair.
Yeah.
Now for my favorite person in the entire world, Robert Christgau for The Village Voice. He did not like this album, which is funny to me because he's either on the right side of history or the wrong side. And it seems like lately on our albums, he's fallen on the wrong side more often than not.
Yeah, he's not a middle ground kind of guy.
He says, and I quote, put James Hetfield out of his misery in under five plays, and that he found found life getting shorter with every song. In his Consumer Guide in 2000, he added that this album is a dud, indicating a bad record whose details rarely merit further thought.
Whoa.
So in 91, he panned it, and in 2000, he doubled down. So
this is probably not very fair of me, but whenever I hear criticism like that from somebody who is, shall we say, advanced in years, I kind of wonder if it's just like, you just don't get it, old man. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, this album, I would not, even the worst track on here that I didn't like personally, I wouldn't call it a dud.
Yeah.
I just don't think it was super effective, but I don't know. He must, I kind of wonder if he just doesn't like hard rock in general. I'd be very curious to kind of like look through his, and maybe I need to do that for the podcast.
I think we should
look through Robert Christgau's reviews and see like, okay, does he really dislike heavy metal or does he really dislike just this album?
Yeah, I think that'd be good. Well, I think we've given the reviewers their due, and it's our turn to talk about our reviews.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Well, for our fans and listeners and everybody who's engaged in keeping track of our scoring system, Chris and I use a 1-6 guitar string review system. One string is a Nickelback album. It sucks. Six strings.
Speaking of people who shamelessly copy James Hetfield in the worst way possible.
Exactly. That's why I brought him up. I've used that analogy before, but they copy Metallica so much, it's not even funny.
Yeah. They're the two dudes in Tunes punching bag for sure.
They deserve it, though. It's well earned. Hey, they made a lot of money. They can handle it. They got thick skin.
Yeah. They'll go home and cry in their beers and their hot tubs and their yachts. So.
It's like a Flight of the Conchords when they spend their per diem on leather clothes. And then a six string album is the highest rating we can possibly give on an album. And sometimes it's accompanied by, you know, other things. Chris, I want you to go first this week. What was your take on Metallica?
So I know that I kind of called Metallica guilty pleasure at the top of the episode, but I don't really think that's inaccurate. I think they're just the other side of a guilty pleasure. I have defended them to my music snob friends in the past because Metallica makes fun music. I have always really enjoyed the kind of caveman energy that they exude. And honestly, like I said before, I think Hetfield is right up there with Angus Young and Jimi Hendrix when it comes to writing memorable musical guitar hooks. Kirk Hammett's guitar playing, which I didn't really touch on that much in the body of the episode, it isn't really always my jam. He kind of makes some harmonic choices that are a little strange, and without getting too much into the like boring side of it, like he just has weird note choices, which a lot of musicians I think kind of take him to task for. But I think on this album, he is really firing on all cylinders. He must have just left his wah pedal on the entire session because there's not a single solo. That's not true. There's a couple of like unwahed solos, but he's always using the wah pedal and it is fantastic and bold and brash. I absolutely love Hammett's playing on this album. I'm probably going to overuse this word a little bit in my review, but heavy music can be super serious, but it should also be fun. And I think especially with Metallica, even with all of Hetfield's growling kind of broody seriousness, there is a lot of fun to be had on this album. We talked about Lars Ulrich, even his kind of like wonky drum sounds and lame beats, are kind of transformed into something better on this album. With all that kind of praise out of the way, something I didn't talk about is that I did feel like there were some kind of sleepy tracks on this album, and it's only 12 songs long. So if you only have 12 songs, they should all be bangers. And I didn't feel like they were all bangers. I kind of complained about James Hetfield's lyrics a little bit. And so with all that kind of in the back of my mind, I kind of feel compelled to ding Metallica's self-titled a couple of strings, but I don't want that to sound like, oh, this album was not fun, because I had a ton of fun listening to it. I would say that this is definitely a very solid four-string album in memory of Cliff Burton, who I think had passed away already by the time they made this album, because I think Jason Newsted was playing bass for him at this point. But four strings in honor of Cliff Burton's low end majesty in their career up to this point.
I think that's a very fair review, honestly. You hit on a lot of the things that I feel about this album as well. This album was on my list, so obviously I think pretty highly of it to have included it. And with that said, this album was an early introduction for me to metal. I'm pretty sure this is the first time I even realized metal was a genre. And up until this week, when we were preparing for this album, if you would have asked me if I was a metal fan, I would have told you, no, not really. I'm not into metal as a genre. And as I was getting my mind around it and listening all to my old playlists and listening to, you know, music by Tool and Rob Zombie and Avenged Sevenfold and Black Sabbath and Slayer and Motorhead and Pantera and System of a Down and Iron Maiden, like all those kind of pulled together for me to go, oh, wait, I do like metal music. And that's because this album brought me back to metal music. What I also realized is the thing I don't like about metal music is screaming. So if you're in a band that is into screamo, that's the part that I don't like at all. And that's why I would have said I don't like metal before listening to this album again and getting into all the old music and going, well, what's different about this and what is it that I liked about this versus other music? So this album really caused me to kind of broaden my horizons a little bit this week. And I'm sure Tiffany is more than tired of hearing me just blare this through any different set of speakers we've got going. So she's ready for us to move on. I can tell you that much. So that said, this album is big. It's competent. It's well produced. Bob Rock is a phenomenal producer. The fact that he was able to get this much out of Metallica, especially when you compare this album to the earlier four studio albums that Metallica released. I feel like those earlier albums are lacking a lot of the soul and spirit that we've come to recognize Metallica for having that does exist on their live albums. Before Metallica in 1991 came out, they released The Good, The Bad, and The Live, a 1990 live recording. And it has the same feeling that this has. So when they're playing live and together, they have a whole lot more chemistry and energy that doesn't come across in their earlier studio albums. This album catches that in a bottle, and it's because of Bob Rock forcing them to sit down in a room and record it together. And that has carried through to their later albums as well. So, yay. It's obvious that I struggled being objective with this album this week. Like, I was excited. I was pumped up about it. I listened to it right before we started recording. So I was like ready to go with this podcast this week. And I will be revisiting this album again soon. I definitely will not wait another 10 years before I listen to it again. It's going to stay on my phone, which as storage space becomes limited, that's a bigger and bigger praise.
Yeah, I hear that.
There are some things I don't like about this album. There are some lyrics that are ham-fisted. There's some vocal delivery things that kind of bug me about James Hetfield's voice every now and then, where it feels like they recorded the lyrics. Well, they obviously recorded the lyrics after everything. And some of it just feels kind of thrown together and slapshod because we got to get a vocal track laid on this. And then there are several tracks of the 12 tracks that I just don't like Lars's drumming at all.
Yeah.
He's not terrible. I mean, he's not the worst drummer ever. But I guarantee you, there's the old story about George Harrison from the Beatles being asked by an interviewer, what's it like playing with Ringo Starr, the greatest drummer in the world? And George Harrison going, Ringo Starr isn't even the greatest drummer in the band. I feel like that's the deal with Lars, too, to some extent. I don't know if any of the rest of the guys play drums, but he's not that good. That's what it comes down to. So with that said, and those kind of things in the back of my mind, I'm going to give this album 5 out of 6 strings. And I think that's pretty fair for it, too.
Right on. I can definitely see that. I do want to pipe up and give some love to my boy Ringo. Because that dude, and I know you're not dumping on Ringo, but it's one of those things that young drummers go like, oh, he's so boring. Any professional drummer you talk to is going to sing the praises of Ringo Starr. So for Lars Ulrich, Ringo Starr, he ain't.
And to be honest, too, I really enjoy Ringo Starr's solo work. Here in the last few years, he's done great. A couple of solo albums that have been just money.
So you want to talk about somebody having fun and not taking themselves too seriously? That is Ringo Starr to a T. Indoors all the time. Well, dude, I think that we have given this I think it's earned pretty good ratings. We both seem to really enjoy it. Do you want to do the least favorite? What do you want to do? What order? What are we going to do here?
I'll start with mine, just because every week I end up saying it anyway. So I'm going to list off all the singles from this, which Enter Sandman, The Unforgiven, Nothing Else Matters, Wherever I May Roam, Sad But True. Those are the singles, and those are all great songs. And if I could pick them all, I probably would. But if I have to pick just one, and since so many of them were singles, I'm going to pick The Unforgiven. They say good music is good music no matter what genre it's in. And over the years, I have heard The Unforgiven played as a strings arrangement in classical music at weddings numerous times. And it's just so good. It's funny that The Unforgiven would be like a strings arrangement for a wedding, but it's there. And I've heard a lot of Metallica music covered in all sorts of different genres, and it always works. But The Unforgiven is one of those tracks that just kind of sticks with me, and I found myself going back to throughout the week. How about you? What was your favorite?
So my my favorite track was definitely Wherever I May Roam. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy the like kind of vaguely Eastern stuff. Like I think Hammett plays like a sitar or kind of vaguely approximates a sitar. Mm-hmm. But man, outside of even just the intro, like the rest of those parts, like it's some of Hetfield's like slickest stuff. Usually kind of imagine him as being like this kind of brutal riffs and stuff, but it's like kind of a, I don't know, kind of a liquid guitar part that he plays for like the hook of the song. And I think it's really cool. Also Hammett's solo is fantastic on this song. It's just more of that like amazing, like super high gain, lots of wah-wah pedal, just like I like to say, chef's kiss. Mwah.
You don't hear this word used often on a metal album, but that song is smooth throughout.
It is. And that's what's so surprising about it. I think it's really good. I almost picked Sad But True because that's another one that is great. And I just want to throw this out there before we go on to least favorites. This song has a lot of Metallica's biggest songs, or this album rather has a lot of their biggest songs on it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those albums where they kind of front loaded it with their hits, and it's really cool. I like listening to it this week. I was like, man, they got a lot of their biggest hits off of just this record.
Yeah, so originally this album and Master of Puppets were on my list as, you know, albums that I wanted to cover. And since this one came up, I deleted Master of Puppets. But that album is the same way. Like, it is top heavy in the hits. Like, the greatest hits could be these two albums, and we could just move on pretty much.
you wouldn't get any complaining from me either. Yeah. It's funny you bring up Master of Puppets, because I was listening to that, like, I think last year, maybe a couple of years ago, I had that in heavy rotation on my phone. I was like, man, this is a good album.
Nice. What was your least favorite track?
So my least favorite track is the song Don't Tread on Me. Its title, much like the image on the album cover, is taken from the Gadsden flag. The lyrics kind of embrace a really hawkish sentiment that I'm not really a fan of. And I think to boot, like if you're just looking at it as a song on the album, I think the music is kind of uninspired and boring. I think part of the problem too is maybe I'm bringing some baggage from just recent events. I don't need to explain all the like details behind the Don't Tread on Me flag. But you know, it's been appropriated by some fairly unprincipled people. And it just kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And I'm not about to lay that all at the feet of Metallica. I think the song, for me, kind of like lives and dies on, it's like sort of lame music and the vaguely like rah, rah, going to war type of lyrics. So that was my one kind of like dip in my enthusiasm for this album. What about you? What was your least favorite tune?
For me, my least favorite tune was The Struggle Within. This track is the one that opens up with a really pseudo, very poorly played drum beat for like a military march.
I'm so glad that you pointed that out.
And then opens into just this expansive metal tune. But throughout the whole time, it's like Lars Ulrich like didn't have monitors in or something. Like he's doing his own thing. And it just doesn't fit with the rest of the album at all. It's almost like if it were a multi-track, they slid him over one bar and he's just off from everybody else by accident. And that's how it got out. The overall mastering of that track is also kind of lame. Just in general, it's not as tight or as fulfilling as the rest of the album. And it's kind of funny. It continues my trend of it's the last track on the album and... I think 5 or 6 times so far, I've been like, yeah, my least favorite's the last track. It's just, let's tack that one on.
Don't close on a weak song. I totally agree. When I was listening to this album the other day at work, I kept looking down at my phone during this song like, is it done yet? Like, why are they still going on? Yeah. Have we not reached the end of the road here? But yeah,
if you're gonna impersonate like... a snare drum for like a vintage military march, get it right. Like, don't do it like that.
Yeah. that's one of the things I'll try and get off my anti Lars Ulrich soapbox pretty quickly here, but it's one of the things where you can see that maybe the ideas he has are decent, but like a snare pattern like that is a basic thing that a lot of drummers have technique enough to do, but he doesn't.
It sounded like fifth grade marching band.
Yeah, he didn't exhibit any like really good technique. It's kind of sloppy. Like, yeah, I totally agree. His drumming no really control. Turns me off.
That's what it comes down to on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is.
Well, man, we've given this album its due. We've trashed the parts we can trash. Let's go talk to the Oracle and see if she's got a cookie for us.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right. So this week we're picking from your list, which is 42 strong, which coincidentally is the answer to the universe.
Hey,
let's see if we get a chance at that one Pavarotti album you got on here. Number 19, Chris, which from your list is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
We're keeping the fun train rolling.
Hey,
I'm excited about that, man.
I'm excited for it, too. This is a great movie, a great soundtrack. I just rewatched this movie like 2 months ago, so I can remember holding Maverick and watching this. I do have to ask, though, does every album on your list have a Coen Brothers tie-in?
Unfortunately, no.
That would be delightful.
Would that it were the case. That would be fantastic. But no. The thing that came to mind immediately is that bit from Fargo where Steve Buscemi's character is sitting in the hotel like conference room listening to Jose Feliciano. And then I think it's like a hooker or somebody is with him. And she's like, so you like the music? He's like, you know, Jose Feliciano, you got no complaints.
Depends on the artist. You know, Jose Feliciano, you got no complaints.
One of the best musical jabs in any movie ever. One of my absolute favorites.
Well, I think that is the perfect way to end this week's episode. Folks, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Two Dudes and Tunes. We hope that you've been enjoying the show as much as we have. If you do like it, please rate and review it from whatever podcatcher you use, and we might even read your comments on the air.
Yeah, and if you guys want to get in touch with us, like we say every week, please shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. Tell us what you thought of Metallica. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday where we ask the question, say, any of you boys smithies, or if not smithies per se, were you otherwise trained in the metallurgic arts before straitened circumstances forced you into a life of aimless wandering? Anyway, you guys take care.